Hello, welcome to The New Economy. I'm Stephanie Flanders, head of Bloomberg Economics. Urbanisation is high on the agenda at the New Economy Forum in Singapore because Mike Bloomberg, as we know, has a bit of a thing about cities. He thinks they can often succeed where national governments have failed. But there's a dark side to urbanisation as well, and by that I don't just mean the pollution and the smog. The risk today is that the world's going to be increasingly divided between people living in hyper-connected, hyper-successful cities and those that are stuck outside. A lot of different things contributed to Britain voting to leaving the European Union and the election of Donald Trump in the US. But you can't help noticing many of the places most likely to vote for Brexit or Trump were smaller cities and towns, places where many people felt they'd been left behind. I'm really pleased we're going to have a discussion about some of these issues later with two of Bloomberg Economics' star reporters, US economy reporter Gina Smalek and Jill Ward. Now, Jill usually covers the UK, but we've just sent her to India to get a taste of something different. After she'd unpacked her bags, I sent her to go find out what the challenges of urbanisation look like in downtown New Delhi.
I've been living in Delhi for over a month now, and the extreme effects of urbanization have become a part of daily life. Today, like many days, Delhi's air pollution is the worst out of any city in the world. On my commute into work, the view of India Gate is getting more and more obscured by thick smog, which gets especially bad in the winter months. Flights struggle to take off because of bad visibility. The roads are packed, and I spend a lot of time stuck in traffic jams. Inequality is starkly visible in the slums right next to luxury hotels and palatial homes. The challenge, both in India and across the globe, is to build the infrastructure and services necessary to keep pace with rapidly growing urban areas. New Delhi's population, which currently stands at 29 million, is forecast to outstrip Tokyo's to become the biggest megacity in the world in about a decade. Across the globe, 55% of the world's population now lives in urban areas, and that's expected to increase to 68% by the middle of the century. The concern amongst economists is that if managed badly, urbanization will exacerbate the global divide between the haves and the have-nots, leading to social unrest. In the US and Europe, city dwellers are already being priced out of ever more expensive urban housing. For American urbanist Richard Florida, the growing geographic split is the greatest political crisis of our time.
In a global environment, just being urbanized and having urbanization doesn't mean that you're going to lift all or even many boats, and that what tends to happen is that you tend to get a lopsided or spiky or winner-take-all kind of urbanization. We face a new urban crisis of mounting segregation, mounting poverty, massive concentrated disadvantage. It's incumbent on all of us to wake up to the fact that this geographic divide, this spatial inequality, this geography of haves and have-nots is creating the greatest political backlash and the greatest political crisis of our time.
In India, the government is trying to act quickly to keep up with the challenge. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has set a series of ambitious targets, like providing housing for all by 2022. He wants to build sewage and drainage facilities across India and create so-called smart cities, using technology to help improve urban infrastructure. For Hardeep Singh Puri, India's Minister for Housing and Urban Affairs, rapid growth in cities means building on a massive scale. Over cups of chai in his office, he told me India needs to build about one Chicago a year.
If you look at the history of what happened in the past, we subjected our urban spaces to neglect. That's putting it mildly. I normally use the word we subjected the urban space to criminal neglect. We were preoccupied with rural development, with agriculture. Now that's important. But the fact is that today our cities provide for more than two-thirds of our GDP and 90% of tax revenues. And this will increase. So you will have more and more people coming into cities, so you need to build, redevelop, And you need to build green and you need to build resilient structures. Our estimate is that between now and 2030, we need to build something like 700 to 900 million square meters of urban space every year, which means one Chicago every year between now and 2030. Can this be done? I don't think that's an appropriate question. You have no option but to do it.
I visited a flagship smart city project, a housing redevelopment for government employees in central Delhi called East Kibai Nagar. It's one of seven similar projects in the capital where 14-story towers are being built to replace two-story houses built decades ago. Set to be completed next year, the new apartments will double the amount of families living on the 87-acre plot to more than 4,500. And they include environmentally friendly features like rainwater harvesting and on-site waste processing. While getting a tour of the site, I noticed several huge environmental-themed paintings on the side of some buildings, like birds, flowers, and a yogi surrounded by branches in the middle of the muddy and dusty construction work. So I guess for the 500 families that are living here now, they can use the drones. Over 200 families living in slums on the site were relocated about 15 miles away. Huge metal barriers now surround the construction area, and once complete, it will be a gated community. Urban planners and environmental researchers are unimpressed with the project. It's faced several cases in court for a lack of traffic and environmental assessments. It also sits on the Ring Road, which circles the city center and is one of the busiest in Delhi. What's more, almost 2,000 trees were cut down on the site. While the company building the complex has planted new ones, critics say they're mostly decorative. Building a 10,000-space parking lot beneath the buildings will make it difficult to recreate a meaningful green space, they say, and it puts at risk an important supply of water. That's vital in a city that may run out of groundwater as soon as 2020. The construction is being funded by the sale of commercial space on the site, but Delhi's High Court ruled in August that some of it can't be handed over since questions remain over how water will be supplied and traffic managed. Delhiites have rallied against the project on social media with hashtags like My Right to Breathe and Delhi Trees SOS. I sat down with Kanchi Kohli, an environmental researcher at the Center for Policy Research, who pointed out a multitude of issues.
So for a city which is dealing with water crisis, these projects are destroying water sources. For a city that is dealing with air pollution, we are talking about a construction project that is increasing both dust as well as impacting air quality. And now a city that is actually needs more green spaces, both for public use as well as mitigating impacts of both pollution as well as heat. These projects, land up replacing those with ornamental trees and landscape gardens, which serve no purpose, both with terms when it comes to air pollution management as well as reducing heat for a city like this. So these are acute problems with the city, which these projects are actually aggravating.
Absolutely.
More than mitigating. So we need development in the city, or any development or redevelopment in the city that helps you address these problems rather than aggravate these problems.
The urban planners I spoke with about the project agreed that Delhi needs more development, but perhaps done in a more inclusive way, one that takes into account the context of the rest of the city. In India, housing hasn't kept pace with population growth, and environmental issues have lagged, according to Sumila Gulyani, who leads work on sustainable development at the World Bank. That means that the kinds of economic returns that could come from urbanization haven't been fully realized. Urbanization has helped alleviate poverty in India, she says, but as more and more people rise above the poverty line, they're landing in a pool that's vulnerable and not quite middle class yet. The rich, meanwhile, are getting richer, while for the poorest of the poor, non-monetary aspects of poverty have actually risen. Many don't have access to basic services like housing, education, and health. That said, Enrico Moretti at the University of California, Berkeley, points out that India's huge informal housing sector at least allows poor Indians to get close enough to job-dense urban areas to benefit from the economic opportunities.
India also makes it hard to develop new housing, formal new housing. But then on the other hand, there is a lot of informality in the housing sector in India that circumvents that. Slums being one extreme case, but there are all sort of intermediate housing arrangement between Islam and formal legal housing developments.
The solution to the challenges of urbanization, economists say, lies in devolving power more locally and promoting inclusivity. And there has been some success in that regard. In Shimla, a city in northern India where the taps ran dry this summer, the state government has embarked on a set of reforms to move the water system from a state-managed authority to the city itself, which could prove a step in the right direction. In the future, much will depend on how growth in cities is managed, Gloria said.
The only way we can really fix our problems is by acting locally. We've revitalized cities from Pittsburgh to Birmingham by forging local public-private partnerships and getting to work to make our cities better. We need a better science of cities. It's a big shift, but I think we're there.
So I've brought Jill Ward up here to Dubai with me, and we're sitting in Bloomberg's Dubai newsroom, and we're going to be joined by our US economy reporter, Gina Smilek, who is sitting in our Boston office, and she's taken a particular interest in the rise of cities over the last year or two. Even as she's covering the Federal Reserve, she's also been interested in how urbanization and growth of cities has been feeding into not just economic growth in the US, but also inequality. So, Gina, thanks for joining us. You've been looking at the US picture. Want to tell us how you got interested in cities and their potential impact on the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that two main things got me interested in cities. First was just that I read a lot of economic research, and this became a major strain starting a couple of years ago of inquiry for a couple of different researchers, including Enrico Moretti over at UC Berkeley. Just this idea that cities are both these areas that foster intense productivity, really dynamic economies, fast progress, and real creativity. But at the same time, because that density can be sort of prohibitive, if it's cost prohibitive for folks to move there, they can also foster inequality. And so he started looking at those issues, and I was quite interested in that line of research. And then the 2016 election happened. And I think that really brought home for me, and I think for a lot of people, this idea that the cities in America were just diverging entirely, both socially and economically, from the rest of the country. And I think you can see that really clearly if you look at a voting map, because the cities are just often sort of dots of blue and oceans of red. And also, I think it was just interesting that we had sort of this national conversation around the election where we realized that you're even sort of the society you hang out in and the things you eat and the things you watch on television are different in cities than they are relative to sort of the more rural areas like where my parents still live and where I grew up. And so that, I think that was really interesting and made me very interested in how the sort of urbanization of America is reshaping how our economies work in the 21st century.
I think that's really interesting because it's something we've come up against in the UK as well. We had years and years of thinking of the great problem cases being those big old inner cities, whether it was Detroit or in the UK, it would have been some of the old mining towns or Sheffield or sort of Manchester. And then those cities have actually had a lot of development and people have moved back into the city. And we've sort of thought, okay, good, that regional problem has been somewhat helped. But in the meantime, there's all of these towns that have sort of fallen by the wayside that haven't had that kind of regeneration. And yeah, the gap between them has grown even more. Now, Jill, you've got an interesting experience because until a few weeks ago, you were living in North London, one of the more gentrified bits of London, if I'm allowed to say that. And then you're now in Delhi, which is slightly different from Mumbai, is where everything is completely crazy and on a kind of crazy scale of frenetic activity in India. But I think Delhi probably comes close, certainly a big contrast with London. Some of those relocations that we were hearing about in the in the program, you know, quite a different feel to this, the regeneration that we've seen in places like Pittsburgh.
So yeah, Delhi is a bit less crazy than Mumbai, I suppose, in the sense that there's actually quite a lot of green space in the center of the city. It's kind of shaped like a donut in terms of this, the center is very green. And then once you get to the outskirts, starting at the Ring Road, which circles the city, it gets much more built up.
We were talking about this regeneration or the redevelopment plan that you've been engaging with. You know, it's quite a different feel from the equivalent thing that you might have, certainly in the UK, where the developers would be forced to have a certain amount of affordable housing and be a little bit inclusive. There's no pretense to inclusion in this place, is there?
Absolutely. So it will be a gated community, and there were actually about over 230 families living in slums on the site before they started construction in 2014 that have just been relocated to kind of the southwest outskirts of the city, about 15 miles away. So that's been one big criticism when I speak with economists, architects, even urban planners, who say really this could be an opportunity to lead to better integration in what is actually a really prime location for Delhi, but instead it will be gated.
And I guess that's one of the things, Gina, that's really striking in the US context. And I've seen Richard Florida, who writes a lot about cities, has talked about this, and some of the other researchers that you were talking about. I mean, cities are a cause of inequality, but that's primarily because housing is such a source of inequality. That once you have the kind of success of inner city, the thing that happens is it becomes incredibly expensive for some of the people who used to live there to be there. And then you've got this increasing wealth inequality. You know, is it controls on building houses that's driving that partly, I guess?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a sort of a large and growing literature that says really our zoning regulations and this idea of not in my backyard, you know, we like inclusive growth, but as long as it doesn't, you know, obstruct our sight line to the nearest local landmark. I think those sorts of policies have really fostered some of these problems that we're having. And you can see it so much in the aggregate data in the U.S. You know, what we've seen is folks with college degrees are just flooding into cities. Folks without them, just it's completely cost prohibitive. They're staying put where they are. And when you think of cities as increasingly the areas where all the opportunity is from an economic standpoint, I think that is going to be increasingly problematic as we, assuming these trends continue, that's going to be increasingly problematic for inequality, both in income and in wealth over the next couple of years and decades.
Do you get the sense, Jill, that there's a lot of thinking around this in Delhi or other Indian cities? Because, you know, it's been a cottage industry that I've noticed over the last few years, people talking about cities as the new drivers of growth and city governments being more important than country, national governments. And it, certainly in Europe, people have done a lot of thinking, and the US, about what makes for a successful city and how can you have the full range of people living in a neighborhood rather than having the kind of segregation that we've sometimes had in the past. Is there any of that in India, or do you feel it's hell-mell for growth no matter what?
So there is a lot of thinking around inequality in India. And I think one of the big problems that came up when I spoke with economists for this story was this issue of governance. And in Delhi specifically, you kind of have overlapping jurisdictions that makes it very hard to plan for infrastructure that you need to keep up with this rapidly expanding population. So that was kind of a big theme that came out of my reporting, that it hasn't been able to keep up in India. And that's why you haven't been able to get as much out of urbanization as you could have compared to other countries in the region, compared to China, for instance.
I mean, where do you see this going, Gina? I mean, is it something, city governments have been quite vocal in America. They do have a bit more power, maybe more ability to plan than some other cities. Do you see a lot of, you know, conscious efforts to engage with this in city planning, or is it just are they too constrained by local interests and some of the planning restrictions that you talked about?
I think there is a growing recognition in the U.S. that this is a problem, and there are certainly some towns and regions that are really making an effort to make sure that they grow in a more inclusive way. One good example of that is the Triangle in North Carolina, the Triangle area, so sort of that Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill region, is really making an effort to expand its transit network in a way that will kind of keep home prices a little bit more evenly spread so that people have access to the economically vibrant areas there. So those local initiatives are happening. I think they aren't happening fast enough to counter the rapid run-up in prices that we've seen in metropolitan housing markets. And so I think this is going to be one of those problems that most folks you talk to will say is going to get worse before it gets better.
I mean, it's certainly, I've talked about, in these podcasts, we've talked about inequality, and we've had also been doing some studies for the New Economy Forum on how inequality is feeding into economic policy around the world. And it feels like the urbanization story provides a kind of mirror image of what's happened globally with incomes, that you've had a big fall in poverty, and in many ways urbanization, the fact that the world has now got more than half of the population living in cities, is a sign of the success of economic development. But it's equally shown up all of the rise in inequality that's happened at the same time. It just seems like, looking around the world, whether it's in India or in the States, we know how to make cities reflect all of our inequalities and the flaws in our economic model. But I can't point to that many cities that have managed to use urbanization as an engine for improving the structure of their economy, make it more inclusive. Maybe that's one of the things that they will find the solution to in their conversations at the New Economy Forum. We shall see. In the meantime, Gina Smilek and Jill Ward, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to The New Economy. Today's episode was reported by Jill Ward with help from Gina Smalik and editor Lucy Meakin, with special thanks to Uni Krishnan. It was produced by Magnus Henriksen. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts.